Training and getting connected. Okay. It is now 9:32 a.m. on July 26th, and I call this meeting of the Committee on Behavior Analysts to order. This meeting is video hosted using Zoom, and the public and parties on this agenda have been properly notified of this fact and have been supplied with meeting access. Ms. Malice, would you please call roll?
Yes, Madam Chair. Dr. Byra?
Present. Sorry, couldn't get off mute.
That's okay. Dr. Davey?
Present.
Ms. Denton?
Present.
Dr. Rates?
Present.
And Dr. Stenhoff?
Present.
We do have a quorum.
Excellent. Well, I'm going to go ahead and take the opportunity before we move too much further into the agenda to make a couple of general announcements and remarks. Today, we're going to be going through the agenda in a little bit of different order. We've got some committee members who need to depart at different times today. And so we're going to go in a little bit of a different order as we go through. One of the things that I think everyone who's on this call should be excited to hear about is one of the first agenda items that we are going to review, which is talking about how the review timeframes of applicants for licensure can be improved. We know that we need behavior analysts in the state of Arizona to assist the population. And we know that there are limitations that are at the board staff level, in terms of having resources to get things done expeditiously. And so as we look at this, I do think that it should be highlighted for all those who are in attendance today that it does not fall on deaf ears that we want to get more behavior analysts licensed in the state of Arizona, and we want to move through things as quickly and thoroughly as possible to ensure that we can serve the need of the public. So I will thank fellow committee members. I will thank board staff, particularly for their efforts in this particular venture and this agenda item. In addition to all of the other things that board staff do, as far as getting things prepared and providing all of the resources necessary to committee members, the tireless efforts to ensure that we do protect the public in the state of Arizona who are receiving behavior analytic services, I appreciate it and I express my gratitude at this time. We will also note here that the Arizona Board of Psychologist Examiners is approved by the Behavior Analyst Certification Board as an ACE continuing education provider. Attending, excuse me, a meeting of the board's Committee on Behavior Analysts is eligible for continuing education credit for maintenance of the BACB certification and for Arizona licensure renewal. To claim this credit, you will make note of code words provided hourly throughout the meeting by board staff. To report the code words to board staff for the purposes of earning continuing education credit, look for the link on the board's meetings page for this particular meeting. Board staff will verify licensees earned credits for attending the meeting with their CE broker accounts. Licensees will be able to view and enter verified credit within 2 to 3 weeks of this meeting. So that's a little bit different than we've done before. Instead of having those continuing education certificates sent out via email by board staff, we are going to be using CE Broker. And this is another one of those areas where we're just looking to be more efficient in our process so we can ultimately get those licensees licensed faster. So that is just general housekeeping. We will move on now to agenda item number 4, which is approval of minutes. We have minutes, both regular session and executive session minutes from June 28th of 2024. Is there a motion for these minutes?
So moved.
Second.
Okay. The motion has been made by Dr. Davey to approve the regular and executive session minutes from June 28th, 2024. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. Is there any discussion?
Actually, you know, upon consideration, I believe I was recused from one of the matters on there, so I probably should not make that motion.
Okay.
Madam Chair, as I reviewed too, I've got recusals up to item 7 on the regular session minutes, and then items 5 and 7 on the executive session minutes I'm also recused from. So I'm going to, well, since Dr. Davey dropped his motion, I think my second falls to the wayside as well. So, okay.
All right. Is there an alternative motion to be made?
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes. Okay. Both executive session and general.
I'll second, Ms. Chairman.
Okay.
Madam Chairman.
The minutes have been motioned to be approved, both regular and executive session minutes, by Dr. Reitz. It has been seconded by Dr. Byra. Is there any further discussion? Okay, seeing none, we do have 3 here for a quorum, so let's roll here. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed? The motion carries. Okay, we are going to hop down. Dr. Davey, your departure time is 10:45, is that right?
Yes, that is correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Well, I want to utilize the time that you are here to the maximum benefit of having the full committee present. So I would like to move down to, let me see here, agenda item number 8. Agenda item number 8 is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding exploring potential application timeframes, improvement strategies. This is what I talked a little bit about in just our general remarks here, and it's how I'd like to kick off our meeting today. Ms. Pakanon, would you provide a summary for the committee?
Yes, I will, Madam Chair. As part of an ongoing, continuous, sustained effort, you know, on the part of the committee board and staff to try to, arrive at more efficient processes for processing applications in spite of the resource deprivation that plagues us. One of the ideas that I brainstormed was to ask the committee to weigh in with, some of their suggestions. And I offered one of my own. And so what I've done is I've summarized those in a table that I hope presents, you know, what considerations need to be made for every suggestion. I do want to frame this a little bit, I guess less so for the committee's benefit, but more so for the public's benefit. So what we're dealing with is, of course, a never-ending and ever-growing stream of applications that come to us. We can never predict how many. We can never predict when they are submitted and so forth. Our job is merely to, rise to the occasion and, process them as efficiently as we can. And to your point, Madam Chair, make sure that, we are doing so, in an error-free, way. So I am, pursuing the, what I think is really the, most impactful short-term solution that we could possibly make at this time. And by short-term, short-term is that's maybe a little bit misleading in that it isn't so short-term. So just to be clear, we have one employee who is only approved to be part-time and only funded to be part-time. And so just by way of history, before July of 2021, we had a single licensing specialist tasked with processing both psychologist and behavior analyst applications. That became, very problematic with enormous backlogs, was not a sustainable situation. So I went through a very exhaustive process to justify the addition of a part-time employee. And that's never a foregone conclusion. It must be essentially reviewed and approved by first the governor through the Office of Strategic Planning and Government, and then also by the Arizona State Legislature. So it is a very intensive process and, you know, necessitates an enormous amount of data and justification for that. So we were able to achieve that goal, and we knew at the time that there is a likelihood that we would outgrow that that level of resources, and we're clearly there. So I am pursuing the expansion of that position to be able to accommodate more time and more funding. Again, it needs to be approved by the Governor's Office of Strategic Planning and Budget and the legislature. And that solution is at least a year away because of the timing when, you know, all of this needs to be reviewed and approved. So here we are, you know, sort of looking at the most short-term strategy that I think will be impactful. I'm pursuing that while at the same time, you know, asking the committee to take a look at these ideas and maybe consider additional ideas. Before I move to the chart, though, and this is new information and not encouraging, as I just explained, you know, we're seeking expansion of the existing position. What I heard from a colleague yesterday was that the Office of Strategic Planning and Government does not consider application processing timeframes to be of concern until they reach 120 to 150 days after submission. That is a standard that I think us as individuals and, you know, I think the consensus would be on the part of the committee and the staff that, you know, we are still trying to strive for a higher standard than that. I think it's, we don't, would not see it the same way necessarily that, you know, the concern doesn't exist until that 120th or 150th day. That being said, I know what I'm up against, and I know that this won't stop me from, you know, requesting expansion of the position. And I do wish to corroborate that information that my colleague heard. I did not hear it from our budget analyst myself. So nonetheless, if that is the position, I'm still moving forward in spite of the fact that we're not, you know, we haven't reached the threshold of concern, you know, in terms of our performance. So I just wanted to sort of frame that, particularly with the new information. And so turning, should I stop there for questions or comments about that before we get to the table?
I have no questions or comments.
Okay, very good. So what the table captures, I think, were all of the suggestions that were sent to me, at least in writing. What I think that several of them, and it's obvious which ones, they do require, if not a statutory revision, one requires a statutory revision. Two, three of these suggestions definitely require an administrative rule revision. That, of course, is has an uncertain outcome, and that's about, in the best of scenarios, I think about a year process. But then also tied to those solutions are, once again, you know, we come back to the need for more funding, funding for, you know, expansion of personnel, funding for the rulemaking itself, and then also, in a couple of cases anyway, system modifications. We don't have the funding, so in addition to the 1 year process to try to promulgate rule changes, concurrently, we would need to be trying to get that approval through the process I mentioned for the extra funding capacity to actually implement these changes. So while I think that the statute and rule changes, you know, have validity, what they don't have is certainty in terms of the outcome, and they don't have an immediate effect. And of course, we know with our severely depleted fund, do we even have the money in the bank account to seek the approval that we would like to have? So those are, I addressed several of these ideas in a collective sense, but I don't want to treat them as, I don't want to be perceived as dismissing them. I just think that this is something that the committee needs to give, you know, some consideration to as you ponder all of this. So I'll stop there because I'd really like to hear, you know, the committee's thoughts.
I'll happily kick off here. I think you presented the information in a very helpful manner to identify, you know, what could be a short-term solution and what could be a long-term solution, what requires that fiscal impact, that, you know, whenever the committee looks at the recent changes in the fund, that could, you know, be more of a long-term desire or game plan. I do think that whenever we look at this list, the one that sticks out the most to me as a potential of moving forward is the discussion of adopting a policy that certain specific application errors are not substantive, and therefore obtaining correct information during the administrative review timeframe, which impedes the application's progression, is not essential to establish that the application is substantively complete. I think that is one that I would like to hear fellow committee members' feedback on. you know, we see pretty consistently when applications come through that, you know, the transcripts show that you graduated on May 9th, and what you put in your application is that you graduated on May 19th, right? And it doesn't change necessarily the fact that you graduated, that you have a degree, right? And then we look at this, and historically, this committee has ensured that information is accurate as it's a legal document, but perhaps we could say that there are particular pieces of information that trumps other pieces of information. For example, your transcript is the verifying document. You know, while we certainly hope that all information is accurate whenever things are being entered, we do know that there are some sources of information that are more reliable than others. So perhaps this could trigger, if we moved in this direction, the need for Ms. Malice to go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth with applicants asking which date is correct, which time frame is this or that. And at that point, she could be more efficient. You know, if she's not having to go back and forth and back and forth, we can get to more work because her time is being used more wisely, perhaps. So, you know, there's that. I think there are other pieces that would fall under a substantive review. You know, for example, if you had a license that we see that the license date doesn't match up for something, right? And we're looking at, was your supervisor actually licensed during the time of your supervision, right? That becomes a little bit different than, oh, you're 10 days off on your graduation date. That doesn't change the fact that you acquired a master's degree. So I think that is something that I would like to see that we flesh out a little bit potentially, but I'm definitely interested in hearing fellow committee members' take on that. It does kind of pivot the direction in terms of what we are reviewing at the time of our substantive review. Ms. Pakkinen?
Yes, thank you. I I think that just to put even, I think your remarks are very insightful. Just to put even, you know, more context around this. So as you noted, often it is these inconsistencies or inconsequential errors that take up so much of Ms. Malice's time, you know, in her ongoing quest and commitment to bring you, you know, clean and error-free applications. It does consume so much of her time to reach out to applicants to ask for the corrections and the edits to what it is that she observes. Takes longer with former supervisors, right? The applicant is highly motivated to correct what Dr. Davey often calls an unforced error, but the supervisors may not see the sense of urgency or not be able to, not be in a position to respond as promptly. So that's a very a common occurrence. So what we're really talking about here is arriving at a decision potentially whereby certain errors or inconsistencies are non-substantive because the verifying document tells the story that we need to tell. It either meets the requirements in statute, the verifying document, or it doesn't. The reconciliation of what is out of alignment, you know, that can happen at a later stage. And it certainly can even be done, you know, post board meeting where the license isn't approved until, you know, the error is corrected. But at a minimum, we have gotten the application to this committee and the application is on a pathway forward and not just waiting for, you know, someone for 2 weeks to get around to making what is a simple, you know, in many cases, correction. And what I do remember, and unfortunately, Ms. Malice was booted from the Zoom, and I don't know if she's been able to join us. She really needs to be here for this conversation. So, at any rate, I do remember that she brainstormed a list. It was an extensive one of all the instances that she could think of that represent errors, applicant or verifier errors. And so my best suggestion would be, you know, if this is a sort of a large concept for the committee to sort of figure out, you know, how do we implement this? Maybe what we do is a committee member or two meet with staff. And what we do is that we recommend that and categorize that certain errors do not preclude an application from coming to the committee. Other errors other inconsistencies do. So in other words, what is substantive, what is non-substantive, and then recommend at what point do we absolutely need that correction obtained to confer the license. So that's the best idea that I have, unless anyone has a better one.
I can chime in, Madam Chair. I think that's a great suggestion. That's kind of where I was going as well. I liked the idea and perhaps getting a smaller group together to organize that and then bringing it back to the larger committee, I think is a wise recommendation. I would be happy to be a part of that small group if the committee chooses to go in that direction.
Dr. Davey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Packin, and hopefully Z is going to be able to rejoin us. So a couple of things come to mind through this. I guess one of them is just more of a pragmatic question. Are we just kicking the can down the road in terms of this license actually being approved? That is, if we're going to continue this down the process of getting it in front of the committee, if there's still dates that are not aligned after the committee says, yeah, everything looks good except for those late dates, Are we still just kind of holding that license in purgatory until those dates are rectified?
Ms. Pakkinen?
Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, that really depends, right? It depends on, you know, who is the owner, who is responsible, you know, for making the correction. And we're talking about not, these are not substantial advancements. What it means is that if an applicant's file didn't make it on the June 28th agenda, and so it must wait for July 26, again, assuming, you know, the what needs to be addressed is addressed. That's a 30-day, give or take, delay, right? But if after board approval, then, you know, Ms. Malis is notifying certain applicants, this needs to be corrected, this needs to be trued up, this needs to be, you know, addressed or whatever. If that happens within 4 days, within 7 days, within 11 days, at least we made up some time, right? So, you know, the gain could be as much as 30 days. And then on the back end, you know, backing out a few days to obtain the, you know, what we need to confer the license, at least we made some progress, right?
So thank you for that clarification. I think that helps me understand that we're not, I mean, that we are, I guess I need to back up a little bit. I guess the next question would be with what is considered, you know, a substantive error and what is not. I'm guessing Jean's going to, Ms. Galvin's going to have a lot to say about what is and what is not correct based on the list we provide her. And I guess that question is for you, Jean.
I would be happy to offer any input that I can and help develop a substantive policy statement that would alert the stakeholders what the board's intention is.
And then my final question that I have around this, inside the portal where applicants can kind of see the process, right? Is there a way for us to pull a report that would show why the delay, who's responsible for the delay, right? So if there is something that's on our end, you know, we need to verify something and we've got an email out to get it verified, that's on us. What about the flip side of that, where we are waiting for the applicant to complete something and that is triggering the delay to no fault of this particular board, the board staff? Is there a way to slice and dice that data set to understand, you know, have some data around what's where the delays are occurring with which party?
Madam Chair, I have an answer to that, and I have to speak to two different, I guess, it's a two-part answer. So now that we have the new summary view in the application portal, then at a glance, it's much easier, you know, applicant by applicant anyway. I can pull up that summary view. Zakiya can pull up that summary view. It is absolutely obvious what is out, what remains outstanding, what we have yet to receive, or has, you know, is in the review process, and who owns that. So yes, we can't do it necessarily, you know, in an aggregate kind of way, but we can certainly do this applicant by applicant. So we could, you know, that I think is a solution that we can sort of lean into. What was the other part of my answer?
Well, before you answer that, to that point, right? And is there a way for us to remind slash alert slash nag slash force the issue? Like, is there a way through, to steal Dr. Byra's term, through fancy technology for us to keep kind of hounding the applicant? And, you know, although that it goes against so many different strong emotions I'm having right now, like, are we reminding them at the 1 week period, hey, you still need to do this at the 2 week period? Are we holding their hand through this process and sending them alerts? The system allows that, correct, Ms. Packing?
Chair Dr. Davey, there are some very recent enhancements to the system, as I understand it, which can send out, you know, some sort of automated notifications. This is going to take a while, I think, for me to sort of figure out how to utilize that technology. And reminder, we have very, very little money this year to sort of have, you know, system configuration issues addressed and so forth. But in my mind, this one would be, I could certainly justify this. We may need to bring in an expert to help us, you know, configure the system so, you know, the notifications of the kind that you are describing go out. And, you know, there's also maybe some alternative solutions that sound something like this. You know, maybe our email system even allows us to issue reminders to a supervisor. We reached out to you 2 weeks ago and we haven't heard back from you. So, you know, this is a reminder, you know, to address this on behalf of your former supervisee. So I will make a concerted effort to look into all of these things to try to figure out, you know, is there not a way to automate what it is that you're describing. I did remember the other part of my answer. The only effective way that I can think of to sort of categorize where the errors are occurring would be for Zakiya, for instance, to go through, you know, maybe 2-3 years of minutes and identify what percentage of applications are problematic at the committee level, where problems are found there, and who owns that or who's responsible for that. What I think is much more difficult to quantify, because Z does this, you know, all day, every day, is, you know, how much is on the applicant, how much is on the supervisor. If she's prepared to comment to that, you know, I certainly love to hear it. Just if she has even a wild estimate or guess as to, you know, what really, where are these problems occurring?
Madam Chair, if I may, input on that conversation. There's two parts to receiving documents. There's the part of, do we have the document? And then the second part is the errors on that specific document. And those are two separate deficiencies that an applicant can receive. So sometimes it can go to the supervisor, sometimes it will go to the applicant, and sometimes there are numerous repeats. For example, one person I'm dealing with, the supervisor said they were sending in the supervision verification, but there was no attachment. There was no supervision verification. So I sent back an email saying, I need the actual document. So then they sent it back. It was only one page of the supervision verification. So I had to send another email saying, it was only one page. I need both pages. So for the third time, they've submitted it, but it's an error on number 9 because they're licensed. They're not in a state where there's licensure. Or so this will be 4 submissions on one document for one applicant that takes time, because I have to track it. I have to know what's going on with each individual, compile all the information in order to get that application to the committee. So it's just, there's a lot of repeats and back and forth for each document where there's an error.
Yeah, and sorry, I don't want to keep cutting in front of Dr. Byra. I think that if I remember correctly, the aging report that I ran just a few days ago, I believe we have 160 open applications right now, 160 for a part-time employee to try to keep up with. So that's a magnitude that is, it's just extreme.
Dr. Byra, if you don't mind, just one comment to that. Ms. Pakkinen, is it possible for us as a standing item on this agenda to get that number? Like, I think it would be very interesting for us to kind of have an understanding of what we're dealing with in terms of backlog. What's sitting out there waiting for applicants to complete their paperwork. Something that would just kind of give the committee a little bit of an understanding of the workload that is sitting just, waiting to fall onto Z.
Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, I think I can get close to, I'm not sure I can get as granular as maybe we would all love to get. Fortunately for all of you, I just completed a little orientation on how to create dashboards for which I've been so eager to have. Relative to, what are our performance metrics in certain areas. And that information should be, the every stakeholder has an interest in that information, not just the committee and the board, but, the public, applicants, policymakers, they all need to see this data. They all need to see our performance metrics and so forth. So I'm committing to working on, building that kind of a resource to better inform us. And I'll keep you informed along the way, again, how granular I can get with this.
Hey, Dr. Byra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Dr. Davey already kind of gave me a preview to the remix here. I am going to talk about technology, but in two pieces. One, I think it'd be really interesting to get some potential applicants to do the application with someone, and I'd be happy to volunteer myself to do that from a user experience perspective. The form itself, like everyone on this committee, especially those of you who have been on it for a long time and board staff, as you read it, of course, everything makes super good sense to you, right? Like it's super clear what we're asking in this document. And remember, we already talked about it on page one, because you guys have been over that information many, 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 many times. For a new, brand new person, they may experience that information and the way it's written very differently than what your intention is. So if there's mistakes being made, I'd like to rule out that it's not that we aren't presenting information in a way that is digestible by those who are applying because they haven't read 500 of them at this point or whatever the case may be. So looking at where is the disconnect? There's a breakdown somewhere that people are misentering information, not including things they're supposed to do. If it's a user experience design flaw, I know that will be there'll be fiscal implications there, as Ms. Pakenham mentioned. But if they're not huge changes, just some verbiage to how we're asking the question or adding an additional prompt to certain questions, I think that from a workload perspective, that should be pretty minimal. We're not asking for huge data coding. We're asking for text box changes. Being in SaaS myself, like if you have workers coming back to you telling you that it's going to cost 10 hours, I suggest you guys use a different vendor because some of the changes that need to be made should be minutes, not hours, to get sorted. Go ahead, Ms. Pacman.
Thank you so much, Dr. Byra. And, I'm just going to give you credit for the last entry on the chart, which was yours, that, there's always going to be opportunity to improve and modify the instructional content that we have in the system. Just, in the system that was a colossal failure that we attempted to use, I think back in what was it, 2016, 2017, and ultimately, had to pull applications out. It was so defective. We could not provide any instructional text specific to our applications. So it was just, it was impossible. So, what I would love is I could even host a student focus group where, we work through the applications together and, anyone can say, time out, what is meant by this? This isn't clear to me. Where does this come in? I would love to do that. I don't know how to assemble any students, but if someone has any ideas, or sorry, I should say trainees probably, you know, maybe AZ ABBA can help me formulate from among their members a group who will sit with me, you, Dr. Byra, and we will just go painstakingly through every text box and look for opportunities to improve that content.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Packham, I might have access to a couple of students or more, and would, without their permission, I guess, at this point, volunteer some of them. I'm sure we could assemble some too. So I just want to throw that out as well.
Yes. What an obvious suggestion. Sorry about that. and the term is voluntold, but
that's exactly it. Yeah.
But to the second point, and again, I know this will have fiscal implications as well, but we have to get technology working for us. We're using an online application tool. There needs to be some automated checks and balances. And again, like, those are not super hard fixes from a tech standpoint to be able to do some conditional statements, do some checking and matching between if you entered it, if you said that in this grid, you got 1,545 hours, and then in another box later, you enter it again and it comes out with 1,560. One, why are we asking the same question twice? But secondarily, it should automatically populate those kind of things if we need it in another area. There's ways within the technology to check that. And I know those are slightly more expensive than just a text box, you know, the dialogue that's in there. But in terms of bang for your buck and return on investment, it should take a colossal amount of work away from Ms. Malice, that she's not going through doing just tedious, non-sensitive changes and call outs and things like that. It should automatically stop you in the system. Don't pass go even. You can't even do the rest of this application until you get this one piece sorted. There are ways for the technology to work for us, but also for the applicant, to prompt them in the right way that this is actually what we're asking for. This is not the right thing that you updated. So they don't submit it. And then they're just waiting, like, hope it looked okay. They should get some of those immediate flags and feedback and have that sorted in real time so that they know exactly what the expectation is, or get a prompt to say, hey, you need to come back in and fix this. And it unlocks the application and they can make those changes. I don't know what it looks like now, actually. I don't know, Ms. Packanon, like, is it locked once they submit the submit button? Can they not go back in and do anything? That's my understanding. And so there's ways for tech to work for us that would take a huge weight off Ms. Malice's shoulders and would allow the applicants insight as to, why is my application taking so long? What do I need to do? What can I do on my end? But I'll stop soapboxing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Packinen.
Yeah, Dr. Byra is absolutely right. You know, we will avail ourselves of every opportunity to improve the system itself. What remains more elusive to us in terms of a solution is how to ensure to the extent that we can what comes to us external from the system is correct, right? I mean, to Zakiya's point, you know, she may have multiple conversations with the same person over what should have been, you know, just a simple matter of, you know, submitting by email a document, right? Another instance that, you know, sort of curious at times, an applicant will submit their own submit their academic transcript on their own behalf. And even after repeated explanations that it must be sent directly by the issuing institution to us and not via the applicant, sometimes we'll receive it three times before the applicant understands what they need to do. So system solutions, yes, let's pursue all of them. What just again, as I said, what remains more elusive is How do we ensure that both applicant and verifier submitted information is done in an error-free capacity and prompt capacity?
Madam Chair, may I add in?
Yes.
Thank you. A couple of issues is that sometimes an applicant will submit an application and there are no documents attached with their application. So I have no transcripts and I don't have a supervision verification. So if I send out the first deficiency, I need those. If there's errors on those, that is automatically going to be a second deficiency notice. And if there's any issues with that, you know, it goes on. But the other issue is I think that a lot of the deficiencies are sometimes on the submitted documents versus the application itself. And sometimes there's a discrepancy between the two that have to be rectified. But I think a lot of it is there's a lot of issues with the submitted documents versus what is actually in the system.
Dr. Davey?
I have so many things going through my head right now. One, I wanted to say I completely agree with Dr. Byra. I think we probably need to take another look at information we're requesting from the applicant that is duplicative of information we're receiving from a primary source. So if we're asking, like, what day did you graduate from Dr. Stenhoff's outstanding ASU program, and they put, you know, May of 2020, and really, you know, the transcript says June, like, are we really, like, is that really important? No. So do we need that question on the application? I would posit no. Like, we've got it from a verify, like, we've got it from the official transcript. Granted, it is the official transcript that was sent by ASU to us. We probably should do a little audit of things that are redundant and get rid of them, just plain and simple, right? If we need the information, it's on the transcript. So I think that that makes a lot of sense. Also happy to be a part of that working group, that working committee. Maybe Dr. Stenhoff or some of the other professors in the room, you know, could even just roll through with their students that are getting ready to apply and look at the things that are duplicative and submit a report back to us for some extra credit. Since we're already short-staffed, let's use some free labor out there. So I think that makes a lot of sense. The other part of me is thinking about what Z just said and that 160 number that's sitting there that needs to be worked through due to errors on the applicant's part. And I'm just sitting here wondering, how much is that then delaying those that today are submitting a clean application, right? So someone who's followed all the instructions, someone who took the time to study what I will say is a not super great process at this point. It is a process. It's the best we have, but took the time to jump through the hoops, maybe made a phone call to Z or to Heidi and got some more information and made sure that they had all the forms completed and took the time and submitted it today clean. But if Z at the end of this meeting gets 15 emails from people that are still not reading the information, still submitting the wrong application, why are we punishing those that did it right? Why are we pushing them off for the sake of handholding others that I won't say due to a lack of detail, but for whatever reason they didn't complete it right the first time? And so I'm wondering also if there needs to be some sort of workflow that those that get pushed back due to an error on the application's part, that they are pushed back. And that is the consequence of not following the instructions, and that those applications that are coming through clean are not held up. Like, I don't know what the possibility of that is, but I get very concerned that we are spending time with, you know, that 80% of our time on applications is dealing with those that people did not follow instructions. And then we only have 20% of time to deal with these new applicants that are crushing it. And they get pushed back because of that. End of soapbox. I don't know how to deal with that, but maybe we figure out some sort of, like, your first error you get put in the spot where we only work with you on Wednesdays and Thursdays. Second air, we only work with you on Wednesdays. And that's it. Like something, I don't know. There's got to be a process to save Z.
Ms. Pekkanen?
Oh, I'm so eager to respond to this. Thank you, Dr. Davy and Madam Chair. Yes, I think that to be clear, we have historically processed applications in the order in which they are received. You know, that seemed to be the most fair and equitable, defensible approach, right? What I'm hearing you describe is that we modify that. And I don't disagree with you. I think that there is opportunity for those, we'll call them flawed submissions, if you will, to be set aside and sort of dealt with, you know, when as Z moves on to the applications that are clean, that are error-free. I think probably to some degree she's doing that, but she and I can talk about some ways maybe to make that more effective. Now that we have, again, I'll return to that summary view in the system, I think she has a better overview, some better tools, if you will, to make those assessments, you know, who might present with a clean application, and, you know, which ones are already coming, you know, with some indicators that they're going to be a lot more effort and, you know, exchange of back and forth of communications and information. So what I want everyone to understand too is that we now have a strategy whereby we are issuing that first notice of incompletion. It's a deficiency notice, application deficiency notice. We are going to be able through technology to issue that much faster. And what that means is that that kicks out for us a 90-day deadline for that application once it's complete to get it to the committee. So by virtue of that, it buys us the extra time for Z to determine, okay, this is the point at which I start paying attention to those flawed applications, but I bought more time to do that. And, you know, that's not particularly palatable if you're the applicant whose supervisor has, you know, submitted, you know, something that is problematic. But to your point, it does get the clean applications potentially on a faster track.
Madam Chair, may I add in?
Yes.
I just did a quick calculation based on the applications that we have received since January. And out of about 110 applications, 18 of those required no deficiency notice. So the vast majority of applications, there's something that I'm dealing with some deficiency of some sort. That's just a quick look at my list of applicants since January of 2024.
Dr. Byron.
Sorry, mute button's a difficult one today. I love data. That's terrible data, but love it nonetheless. I agree with Dr. Davy. We shouldn't, well, even though there's only 18 of them that should have been fast-tracked. But I do want to touch on something, you know, Ms. Pacino, what you said about supervisors being inattentive or not doing the right thing. Like, I'd like there be some kind of thought about how many times over what time interval. If I was Ms. Denton's supervisor and she emails me on May 1st and I don't respond, and she emails me again on May 14th and I don't respond, and she emails me again on May 28th and I still don't respond, like, at what point do we say, hey, Dr. Byers sucks at this and this is not Ms. Denton's fault? Like, we need to, you know, proceed with this and send Dr. Byers some kind of letter about not responding to board requests. I don't, to my knowledge, there's not a hard and fast rule of when do we call it enough is enough. They've done their due diligence trying to contact their supervisor. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't want candidates to be penalized because the person who did their supervision isn't responding. Or, I mean, for those of us who are older in this field, I'm very glad that I got my license a very long time ago, because my advisor is in his late 80s, and I will guarantee you he doesn't remember what he had for breakfast, probably, never mind where my verification forms are, nor would he be responsible for keeping them this long ago. Another soapbox ended. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Dr. Davey. You're muted.
All right. So I said it is a day of soapboxes. So a couple of things. One, we definitely need to do kind of the redundancy review of source data and applications, or source data and what needs to be put on an application and get rid of that potential hiccup. But I think if we could get from Z, if she already has it, maybe with her potential idea, is an error analysis, right? I think that can drive some intervention. Do we know what the top three reasons are? I mean, for goodness sakes, the, you know, down and dirty of it is only 10% of applications are coming through ready to roll to us. So what, where are we falling short as a field in making sure that the input information that's being sent forward is correct? That number is pretty shocking. And so if we could understand, of the other 100 that are getting, you know, kicked back, 15 of them was because they decided to just send us a copy of their own transcripts versus getting us, you know, ones from the, you know, from the universities. Another 15 of them were because they failed to fill out the right supervision form, you know, another 50. Like, if we had some kind of understanding there, then I think we could also push that out to the state associations. I think we could push that out to our existing LBAs about, hey, if you're supervising, these are the reasons why your team is not getting licensed quicker. And I think there'd be some agencies that would be very interested in that, that continue to send Heidi letters about why are things go slow. And so we would be able to provide them with, listen, here's the top five reasons things are slow, and you should be making sure your applicants understand that these errors are just not acceptable. These are the ways to fix them. So I for one think that that may be a path for us, and we can get that information to the public and let those that are concerned move forward.
Dr. Davey, I like that idea very much. Ms. Pakkinen?
I agree. Z and I will definitely work on that very idea. If we're sort of coming to the toward the end of this conversation, I don't want to miss an opportunity to articulate to anyone who is either attending this meeting. Oh, now there's someone I really want in this meeting who I just admitted from the waiting room, Dr. Davis Wilson. I really want everyone here is a stakeholder, right? I really want to see a outpouring of support for the funding requests that I am making, even if and I don't know this to be the case necessarily, but even if it doesn't stand a chance, because we're not great, but we're not terrible enough. I'm still, as I said, I'm moving forward with the request. I am going to pour everything that I have into the justification to staff up. And so letters of support from groups, from individuals, you know, particularly with insights into waiting lists and, you know, time to obtain credentialing. If I receive 100 letters, they're going into the submission, you know, just to try to make what I hope isn't a futile case. But, you know, please, by August 14, send me your letter, it will be in the submission.
Ms. Pakkinen, how would you like that letter? Would you like this with a wet signature? Would you like this emailed to you? Would you like it snail mail? Like, what is the best form for this outpouring of support?
I'm pretty much going to insist on email.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. So with this agenda item, we have proposed a few different things. Okay, Dr. Byra?
Sorry, just before we move on from this, I see there's not a huge attendance today for this meeting. So just in terms of asking for those letters, like outside of this committee, and folks who happen to be on the call today, I'm just wondering if there's a short snippet or some kind of email that we could ask maybe the folks of Aziaba to send out to folks, or something like that. I'm looking at the date right now. It's about 2 weeks out. To be able to disseminate that request to more folks than those who are on this call or may listen to this recording at some point.
Yeah, it looks like Aziaba dropped off just a few minutes ago.
Yeah, but I can speak to that. Excuse me, Madam Chair. Aziaba has received my plea. I think I made it last week at any rate. And so I expect that they will, put what support they can behind it. So that's what our conversations have reflected anyway. But any voice, any perspective is welcome. And I do appreciate Aziaba very much.
Dr. Davy.
I know this was like the first idea on the spreadsheets. Were we thinking we were moving on from this topic altogether, or are we just moving on to further down the spreadsheet?
Madam Chair, Dr. Davey, if I could weigh in, I think we want to circle back to some of these ideas too. I don't want to suggest they don't have merit. I just wanted to frame the expectations, but I would like to have this conversation in the relatively near future. I think that particularly those instances where statutory change is necessary, we sort of need to assess the legislative landscape, which we can't do, for 2025. We can't do that until after the election, of course. We can coordinate some ideas potentially with Aziaba. They may or may not be receptive to, a sort of partnership to achieve some statutory revisions. That's again depending on the landscape. Where rulemaking is concerned, I will be going for the Governor's Regulatory Review Council next Tuesday and then the following Tuesday. And I want to come away with a sense of, how receptive might this council be to some proposed rule changes that we would need to pursue. So I feel like that's coming. We're not so these ideas are still, I think, very much alive, but we know there's a heavy lift and a lot of uncertainty ahead. So but n we're not taking them off the radar as far as I'm concerned.
That's fair. And sorry, I had to turn off my video because I was getting an unstable network connection. That's fair. I do think a couple of those ideas came from me, and I know that I shared, more detail than what's in the spreadsheet in terms of looking at temporary licensure as a possibility. And I do understand that maybe that's a long game that may take us a year and a half. But I am also of the mindset of let's throw everything we have at this and see what sticks. I mean, maybe it is the temporary licensure that gets through faster than additional staff. Maybe additional licensure or temporary licensure allows us to put in another request for temporary staff to deal with it. And so I would just be open to us continuing some of those conversations and knowing that there's statutes that would support this idea of temporary licensure, particularly in particularly across multiple professions, whether it's the nursing board, the medical board, the neuropathic board, the osteopathic board, like some of there's instances of this occurring for good reason. And I think that we now as a field have kind of hit that crossroads of we've got some good reasons to need to be able to provide perhaps a temporary path while some other things shake out. And so I don't want to give up on those possibilities just because they may be harder or perceived as needing a legislative champion. I think that partners like Aziaba, providers in the community that are feeling the pain of these delays, they may be some of our best champions in moving forward and helping drive some of this and get us going in the right direction if that's what's needed. My next question around some of the workload, Ms. Pakkinen, that needs to be done. Does the board have any mechanisms to receive grants, financial contributions to help with like system upgrades or, temporary leave, like someone who might be a guru inside of our technology platform that could come in and set up all those alerts for you for, $1,500. Like, do we have the ability to like fundraise, hold a bake sale, something to be able to help drive this since our budget, not our budget, but since our financial apparatus have been curtailed by the sweep, and then also it's obviously curtailed by some of the stipulations that come with our budget. So do we have any mechanisms there to be able to tap into donations, outside resources?
Great question, Madam Chair, if you don't mind me fielding it since it was directed at me. I'm looking at the statute 32-2063, which is powers and duties of the board, way at the bottom, subsection 14C, subject to section 35-149. I haven't read that statute in forever, so forgive me. The board may accept, expend, and account for gifts, grants, devices, and other contributions. What I suspect is that 35-149 and then a few other statutes that are cited here, my hunch, and I'll research them, I promise, but my hunch is that the hitch would be that we can receive the monies, but that the legislature must still give us the permission to spend it. In other words, appropriate it to us. So it isn't to say that we can say, thank you, Dr. Davey, for your generous donation of $10,000. We can put it immediately to use. Was that too low? 25,000? Is that what you were thinking? At any rate, I don't think it's, I think there's still, that appropriation piece that we would have to secure that is, frankly, quite challenging. So I'll look into that and I'll have a better answer for you later. And you can sort of think about how much you want to contribute.
Yeah, thank you. It would be much less than any of the numbers you threw out. But just thinking like about our associations and some of the providers that are feeling the pain for this. And then, this is really an access to care issue as well. I mean, at the end of the day, our ability to license individuals is inextricably linked to our ability to serve the families of the state of Arizona. And I think that, as we have these discussions with legislators, as we have these discussions, like we've really got to tie that together. And I hope that perhaps in the letter writing campaign that you just spoke of, that many people will make that direct connection, that this is about access to care and our delays of being able to license individuals because of being understaffed is just not acceptable today. And we have a way to rectify it. We've identified the way to rectify it. You've put that forward in terms of budget items. And so I do believe that we need to make sure that our letters connect those dots.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Davey. One more thought too. I know something that we would also have to navigate would be the gift clause, which I know very little about. No one gives me gifts in my professional capacity. Curiously, but that would be something too that would be, a consideration that, we would have to make sure that any well-intentioned contribution didn't run afoul of that statute or those statutes as well. Right, Ms. Galvin?
That would be one consideration. There would be a number of things that we would have to work out. The statute that Heidi referenced that allows the board to accept grants, donations was enacted when the psychology board accepted this collaboration with BAs, and there were BAs submitted money for kind of the startup costs, and that statute was enacted to allow the board to accept that. When you get into discussing, money or donations, to upgrade systems or hire personnel, that there's going to be a lot of interaction with the Department of Administration. to ensure that something like that could be, you know, worked out.
Yeah, I just think the more paths we're looking at, the better. And I do apologize. I have to leave in 4 minutes. I apologize to the committee for that, but I'm going to go see one of my colleagues do a presentation here in Atlanta. So,
okay. Are there? Do we need to make any motions as a part of this discussion?
Madam Chair, I don't see that one is necessary. What I heard was I heard Dr. Rates volunteer to assist with working with staff on the curated list of, you know, what are administrative errors and what are not and non-substantive in the process and what are substantive errors. If anyone else wants to volunteer, great. But I think, you know, we are in very capable hands with Dr. Rates, if only. And then staff heard, and we'll continue to discuss the other kinds of things, the other ideas that have been proposed. I know Dr. Stenhoff will be in touch with me. Aziaba has already indicated offline they'll be in touch with me. So I think we can move some of these non-tech, non-cost solutions forward and continue to explore them.
Okay. Excellent. Then I think we should move to agenda item number 6. We've got 3 minutes left with Dr. Davey. Let's see how far we can get. Agenda item number 6 is discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning the potential revisions to Arizona Administrative Code R4-26-406. Ms. Pakkinen, will you provide a summary to the committee?
Yes, very briefly. I think that the committee is well aware of, you know, what is the concern with this rule, the deficiency with this rule, which is it doesn't cite to a specific version of the BACB Code of Ethical Conduct and cite the date in the process. Where you last left this was you wanted to give this, I think, a little bit more thought and then come back to it. So that's exactly what we're doing today. So I think the committee needs to make a decision about where you want to land in terms of which code to cite, which version, and be clear about, you know, what date is attached to it. And then we bring this to the board with a recommendation for the rule revision. Frankly, I think they're expecting it. And the by way of reassurance, if this takes some time, and we know it shall, to fix the rule, in the meantime, you're not powerless because of the other language you have in 32.2091 subsection 12. With that, I will pause for questions.
Yeah, just this question is really geared towards Ms. Galvin. You know, I think I've seen some, you know, put my legalese hat on here. There's some language that essentially can follow, like, you know, we will accept the ruling of, you know, say this committee or its predecessor or this document or its predecessor. Is there any language that allows us to, like, in perpetuity, incorporate the updates without us every single time going back and saying, as revised on this day or now version this date? Like, is there not some, like, sort of fancy legal term that says, you know, as this is updated, like, we've accepted this document, and in perpetuity, as that document progresses, we are going to continue by statute accepting the newest version of that.
And that's what the board tried to do when it promulgated the current rule, and, you know, it was accepted by GIRC, and now it's in question. While that is a noble idea to have some sort of language like that, there is a statute that says thou shall not do that, and thou shall state a date specific.
And shall means must in legal terms, right? I mean,
it does. Yeah. And so, unfortunately, or fortunately, you have to update your rules as the document you are incorporating by reference is updated.
And what if we, what if the BACB said, listen, we know on our strategic plan, we have an update coming in 2027, we have another update coming in 2023 or 2030, and another update in 2033. Could we include those as part of our language, that the updates that are scheduled for 2027, 2030, and 2033 will be included in this? Could we include that in our language if we had kind of the strategic plan, the strategic roadmap from the BACB?
I don't represent the Governor's Regulatory Review Commission, but my thought is that that would not be accepted. And there is also the assumption that before you incorporate a document by reference and require the licensees to comply with it, the board has also reviewed it and agrees with it.
Fair enough. I'm out of brilliant ideas to try to get us around it, so I will let the rest of the committee come up with what I'm sure I'll be willing to support moving forward. Thank you all, and I will try to join back in if the meeting's still going on just a little bit.
Bye, Dr. Davey.
Goodbye.
So I think what I would recommend is, you know, as Dr. Davey did point out, we do hear from the BACB typically in advance when something is going to be updated, typically in a decent amount of advance. If we're having a new version of the ethics code, or, for example, a new task list or testing content or whatever it might be, I would propose that we incorporate by reference the ethics code for behavior analysts that was copywritten in 2020 and was updated in February of 2024. Trying to look at everything we have to incorporate in this, incorporating a document by reference information here. But as we know that the BACB is going to update it again, we get ahead of that in our rulemaking revisions. And we say there is a new one coming out. When it comes out, we will just be right there, you know, ready to revise again. While it may not be the most expeditious process, would that work, Ms. Galvin?
It's hard to say, and I don't want to make a representation because it would have to go through the Governor's Regulatory Review Commission. So I don't feel comfortable opining on what they may or may not accept. Yep. The statute is pretty clear that you have to give the date of the document that you are incorporating by reference.
Okay. Ms. Pakkinen?
So I do think, to your point, Madam Chair, given that most professional associations provide for years in advance notice to stakeholders about just exactly what you said, there is a revisionary effort launched or underway to review the Code of Ethics, the Code of Ethical Conduct, whatever it's called. And so that puts regulators on notice, regulatory boards on notice, that that's something to pay attention to and anticipate, you know, a possible version in the next couple of years. By way of reassurance, this is, I know this to be true. I've always known this to be true. And so, you know, part of our budget is set aside for the cost of rulemaking, if the board elects that they, you know, want to keep pace as closely as possible with the current version. So don't be concerned about that. If we don't use the money for rulemaking, we'll put it in technology. Don't worry, I'll repurpose it. But we always have a set aside in instances like this to be able to be responsive. And I think I enjoy coming from a state like Arizona, where its leaders in this profession, in both professions, really, you know, have really well, they know well in advance, or they're even participating in, you know, a revisionary process. So that just makes it much easier for us to make the changes when we need to, is, you know, by virtue of having those relationships and liberally sharing that information with each other.
Excellent. So if we were to incorporate the most recent version of the BACB Code of Ethics Code for Behavior Analysts, do we need to state in open meeting the name and address of the agency, the organization or association that developed the material, the publisher's name and address, the copyright date, the release date, the revision date? Does that all need to be said in open meeting?
It's part of the rulemaking.
Okay.
Yes. So, Madam Chair, you can give me the direction that you want to move in. I mean, this is the specificity. Don't worry, I'll take care of that. Really, what I'm looking for is the version, the year, which version that you want to recommend to the board that rulemaking proceed, be promulgated, to make the change, and then I'll work with our rule writer to ensure that it reflects the committee's direction and the board's direction. You'll see that draft language before it's ever proposed, so it'll come back to you.
If I'm correct here, it is the code that was effective January 1st, 2022. It says on the document that it was updated in February of 2024. Fellow committee members, are you seeing the same?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm reviewing it right now. Are you looking at the code itself, Madam Chair? The booklet?
Is she frozen?
Yeah, I
Is
think
that
Madam
okay?
Chair is frozen.
Oh no.
Oh no,
Can
there she's. Sorry. Yeah. Ms. Pacanon, Ms. Galvin, do I need to wait? I was just going to concur that there is an updated mark on the document of February of 2024.
So I don't know if they view that as an update or a whole new addition.
Now, I think the addition is, yeah, I'm not sure at what point they considered a new ethics code.
And Dr. Stenhoff, yeah, I'm thinking about this. I'm processing the same thing that you are trying to. I think that what the proposed language may need to reflect is exactly as it's quoted by the BACB, which is the 2022 version updated in 2024. The whole point of the rule is to give absolute clarity and transparency to what specific document to which we are referring. So if the rule needs to get a little bit, sort of, have these other qualifiers about, it was adopted, approved or adopted on this date, but updated. I think that can be all addressed in the rule. And then there's no ambiguity to anyone. They can go to the BACB website or request a copy from the board office as the rule requires. And we can say, here it is. And they can confirm it is the version that it is. And, we're just mirroring their language in the rule. It's my hunch. I'm going to ask our rule writer to weigh in on that too.
Dr. Stenhoff?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And to Dr. Davies' point earlier, I mean, here we have an updated 2024. If there's an additional update between now or the revision of the rule, the submission of the rule, and just prior to the approval of the rule, without the those that approve the rules, that things could change before the rule. The rule could be in whatever committee, whatever you want to refer to it as. The rule could be in committee and be changed at the same time by the BACB, or at least updated. But Ms. Galvin, from what I understand, that could happen, and we're going to have to go back and revise the rule, or the powers that be would have to go and revise the rule. Is that correct?
There is a provision that allows an agency during the rulemaking process to make changes from the proposed rules to the final rules.
Okay.
And if that change isn't substantive, your final rules can differ from your proposed rules. So without knowing what those changes may be, there could be an argument that the changes that were made during our rulemaking process were not substantive in nature, and therefore the rule can proceed. But that would all be dependent upon what changes were made. But you may not have to start over.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
And it may be, you know, at that time, staff can reach out to the board and see, you know, what do you guys got? You know, what do you have going on with respect to the code, or any imminent, you know, amendments planned?
All right. Thank you.
With this information, do we advise board staff to gather the necessary information about this particular version of the code, gather all of it, and then make a motion? Do we make the motion after that information has been gathered? I'm not sure procedurally how to advance right now.
So what I recommend is that because this needs to be a recommendation to the board, forward to the board a recommendation. You know, what do you want to which version do you want specifically this rule to cite to, which version of the code, so that the board can authorize a rulemaking, approve your recommendation. I am receiving some external communications that reflect that the BACB has a practice of reviewing their code every 5 years. So that is, you know, something to keep in mind. That's very frequent relative to what, in my experience, any other association. Often it's a decade or more before, you know, an association will sort of find, you know, compelling reasons to come back and, you know, review and potentially update the code. So I think there needs to be some acknowledgement that we're not always going to be able to keep perfect pace with the BACB. So be it. We may be chasing code versions and be, you know, a year behind, 18 months behind. There's nothing wrong with that.
So, does any committee member wish to offer a motion?
So, I think the motion would be, if you are interested, to recommend to the board that they proceed with rulemaking, adopting the 2022 version of the ethical code with amendments as of February 2024.
So moved.
Second.
Okay, the motion has been made by me. It has been seconded by Dr. Stenhoff. Is there any discussion? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion carries. Ms. Malice, can we get a code word? I know we're about half an hour over the time frame.
Yes, Madam Chair, you can get a code word. The theme has to do with back to school. So the first code word is school. Thank you.
Okay. I think at this point on the agenda, we can probably move up to our behavior analyst applications for licensure, which is agenda item number 5. Agenda item number 5, discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations to the board pertaining to the approval of behavior analyst applicants. Dr. Byra, I did intend for you to go first. Is that why your hand is raised?
No, I was wondering before we go through those 11 applications, could we do a quick comfort break?
Of course we can.
Thanks.
What are we thinking? 5, 10 minutes? 5. Okay. 5 minutes it is. We'll be back on at about 11:06. All right. Well, as we mentioned before our brief comfort break, we are moving to agenda item number 5, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recommendations to the board pertaining to the approval of behavior analyst applicants. As we go through today, I am going to prioritize Dr. Byra's applications on which she is the lead as she has an early departure time. And maybe we're going to get through all of these very quickly and it will be a moot point. But nonetheless, that is the direction we are going to go. So Dr. Byra, I will have you kick off the application review process with applicant number 1, Layla Hadid Ayoub. I hope I pronounced that correctly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So going through this applicant's review, the supervision hours is 1,545, which meets our standard for the 1,500. However, those hours were done in the state of Michigan, which is indeed a licensure state and was one during the time of supervision, which started in March 19th. However, the only supervisor listed is Seth Young, who did not get his license in Michigan until January 2nd of 2020. I don't have a breakdown of how many hours were done prior to that January time. So I don't know if the applicant's on the call, if we could perchance have an opportunity to ask her. But if not, then I would recommend that we be issuing a FAIR to get more information about additional supervised experience.
It does look like the applicant is on the line. Are you able to unmute and be available for a few questions?
Hi, sorry about that.
Hi.
Yes, I'm able to answer a few questions. It was under my impression that he was licensed. At the time, I can't give you the exact hours after he, like at the moment right now, I can't give you the exact hours that I did before he was licensed. I can figure that all out and send it your way through email. And then I can calculate when he was licensed, how much hours I did receive with that.
Okay.
Can I ask a question as well?
Go ahead, Ms. Madam Chair.
Have you accrued any additional supervision since the time of your application by a licensed behavior analyst in the state?
So after I submitted all that, yeah, I sat for the board exam. And then I took time off, personal reasons. And now I just started working again, actually in June. So I can have the opportunity to accrue more hours with a licensed behavioral analyst here in the state of Arizona. I just haven't because I was unaware of the situation. It was kind of a shock for me as well. So, yeah.
Just to pull on a thread that you just mentioned, you said you just started working again in June. Is that here in Arizona? And is that in the capacity of a behavior analyst?
Yes.
Go ahead, Tisha.
So the follow-up question that I would have then is, if you're acting in the capacity of a behavior analyst, are you being overseen by a licensed behavior analyst in Arizona who is overseeing your practice?
I'm being overseen by a BCBA that is licensed in Arizona.
Okay. Madam Chair, you have to remind me for precedent on if we need to make a motion to issue a fare to get those additional application hours by someone who is licensed.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. Galvin, but a fare can be lumped into the entire motion that we make at the end. Together, but I would anticipate that this would be, we would move that it is a fair to gather additional information surrounding the total number of supervised hours that occurred prior to Seth Young's licensure being obtained in Michigan. And I would also like to know if there are additional hours that have been accrued from June until, you know, the fair comes back that could potentially serve in the direction of getting enough supervised hours, those 1500 supervised hours, by someone who is licensed in the state that you're practicing in.
So you can include the request for a fair in your motion with the other applicants.
Okay. So I'll hold off until then, but that would be my recommendation right now for the board, is that we have a fare for those additional supervision hours.
Excellent. We will move next to application number 6, which is Heather Barone Galvin. Dr. Byer, that's you as well.
Thanks. Sorry, just pulling it up on my other screen here. In reviewing of this applicant's file in terms of education, supervised experience, examination performance, all of that seems to be in alignment. However, I did want the opportunity to ask a question if the applicant is available.
Yes, I am.
Okay, great. There was some notes that you are currently supervising RBTs. And need to be able to bill. So I just want to make sure that if you are here right now in Arizona and you are working as a BCBA, that you are also under the supervision of a licensed BCBA here in Arizona.
I am not acting as a BCBA. I'm a lead psych for a district, but I applied because they would like to be able to use me in the capacity of a BCBA and bill for that. And we also have some candidates that would like to be RBTs. And so my district is wanting me to be board certified so I can do that.
Okay. Okay. So I'm going off the information.
Yeah,
the
no, consent. And it could have been unclear.
Okay. So just to be clear, you're not currently supervising any RBTs.
I have an RBT in South Dakota that I was supervising, but I didn't realize I had to be licensed because she's out of state. I thought I could supervise her. So I did not know that.
Okay. But here in Arizona, you're not doing any supervision.
Nope, I am not.
Any questions from my fellow committee members?
Not that I have for me.
Okay. All right. Then I would recommend that this go on to the board for acceptance.
Is that all of yours? Did I? That's your last application, huh? Look at that. We got through that quickly. Okay. We will now just go in numerical order for the remainder of these. We're going to go to applicant number 2, which is Kyra Oakland. Dr. Rates, you're the lead on this application.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declaration, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete. I would recommend that we move it forward to the full board.
Wonderful. We will move to applicant number 3 next, which is Abigail Gonzalez. I am the lead on this application. In my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination performance, and declaration, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete and would recommend that it moves forward to the full board for potential approval. We will go to applicant number four now, which is Bailey Fritz. Dr. Stenhoff, you're the lead.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete and recommend that it move forward to the board for approval.
We will go next to applicant number five, which is Rafael Prieto Moreno. I am the lead on this application. In reviewing this file, there were a couple of items to discuss. First off, question number four of the application was answered as yes. There is a criminal history that reflects several infractions from 1995 to 2009, but it should be noted and was also in the applicant's written declaration that there have been no infractions since 2009. All required court actions have been taken, professional development has occurred, and the applicant has been a certified educator, certified under the Department of Education since 2020, in good standing. So, you know, given that there has been a substantial period of time of about 15 years of no criminal activity, I personally am not concerned with the safety of the public, given these infractions. So then whenever I come here, there is one piece that I think we're going to need to get corrected before we can move forward. The supervised work experience or independent field work verification form from Hillary Ottaviano is missing the name of the applicant in section A, so it doesn't have our applicant's name on it, as well as a signature from the supervisor. So while that form was submitted, we need some additional information for that form to be complete. There was a corrected date on there whenever it came through the final experience verification form and the submission, thanks to Ms. Malice. I'm going through that and hopefully we'll expedite this process so she needs to do less of this in the future via our earlier conversations today. And then there is another item, which could be a non-substantive issue, but until it goes forward to the full board for agreement, I would like to see that it is fixed, which is Rebecca Pawlowski. Okay, I'm going to quit trying that. Her BACB registry shows that she completed her supervisor training on August 9th of 2017, and the application states that she completed it on August 19th of 2017. So I would recommend at this point that we issue a FAIR. The FAIR would be that first additional information request, specifically here to get information surrounding the supervised work experience or independent fieldwork verification form for Hillary Ottaviano. And getting the name of the applicant on that form and getting her signature on that form as well. I would like to be clear that this is only for the completeness of the application and does not have anything to do with the response of the applicant to question number four on the application. I thought I saw that the applicant was on the line. Applicant, do you have any questions about this process?
Hi, thank you. Yes, I do. So I need to go back to Ms. Ottaviano and get her to give me another form. What do I need to do? I've been waiting so long for this.
Yeah, so what we will do is we will send out a letter that details, board staff will send out a letter that details everything that needs to be done. But what is going to be requested in that letter is that Hillary submits that form back to the board staff with the all information completed, including your name being listed as the supervisee that she oversaw. And a signature from her on that form. And then there would be an amendment that is requested just, and it would be that the supervisor training date for Rebecca would be listed presumably as the BACB certificate registry. Would we need a fair to clarify that information, or could we just clarify that since he is on the line right now to say which one is correct?
I could log, yeah, it's the one that's on the BACB registry. I could go in there right now and just double check it.
We have it pulled. We have
Yeah, that's the
screenshots.
correct one. If I mistakenly put 19, I'm so sorry. I've
Okay.
been waiting so many months for this. It's so stressful.
We, as you've heard, we are going to be doing many things to try and make this less stressful for both applicants and board staff, as we are moving through here. But we do need that piece from your supervisor, Hillary, to make sure that the application is complete. So a letter will be coming your way. You could give Hillary a heads up, like, hey, that form that you submitted, you left off the name, you left off my name, and you left off your signature, and we do need that information. So even if she wants to send it in to board staff before the fair comes, I don't think board staff would be upset to receive information earlier than anticipated.
So what does fair mean? Like
It is a
what does that mean?
first additional information request. So it's a formal process that we have to say that we need more information before we can move the application forward.
Okay, and is that gonna be a new meeting?
Nope. So it will be a letter that comes to you. In that letter, board staff will detail exactly what you need to finalize your application. And then, depending on how quickly that gets back, will depend upon when it gets back to the committee again.
And we'll have to wait until another committee has a meeting again to go over it again.
So I'm going to direct the rest of your questions to board staff, probably outside of this meeting, as far as
Okay.
the time frame goes of when that would be reviewed and how that would go. There's a lot of factors that go into the timing of when an application can come back, particularly how, for example, how long it would take to get information from your supervisor and if that falls outside of the meeting dates that are already set aside. So I don't feel like I can adequately answer that question at this point in time, but you are absolutely able to communicate with board staff outside of this open meeting.
Thank you very much.
Of course. We will move on to applicant number seven. Applicant number seven is also an application that was assigned to me. This is Stephanie Fornichario. Is she on here?
Fornaseri.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So while reviewing this application, in my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete and would recommend that it moves forward to the full board for potential approval.
Thank you.
Of course, thank you. We will move on to applicant number eight. Applicant number eight is Jasmine Alexander. Dr. Rates, you are the lead.
Madam Chair, in my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declaration, I find it to be both administratively and substantively complete. I will just make a note for the record that the individual is also in good standing with a license through the Department of Ed in Arizona, as a special education teacher. So, with that, I would recommend that we move it forward to the full board.
We will move to.
Wonderful. Thank you, guys.
We will move to applicant number 9, which is Kevin Lowen. Dr. Stenhoff, you're the lead.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervisor experience, examination, performance, and declarations, I find to be administratively and substantively complete. I also want to note that Mr. Lowen holds a qualified applicator license in California. And also he replied yes to a declaration on question 3 on page 13 of the PDF related to a complaint, allegation, or investigation. Regarding the allegation that was submitted to the BACB declined to notice, declined the notice due to the lack of sufficient or conclusive evidence. The facts were inconclusive and are in dispute, not decipherable, or maybe retaliatory. So essentially the BACB dismissed this issue. I don't know if Mr. Lowen is present. I don't know if you'd want to make any further statements. If he is in fact present, I'll wait a moment to see.
I am, if you can hear me.
Yes, we can. Yeah.
Yeah, you've got it correct there. It was expected to be just a retaliatory complaint. Working in the public sector previously, you learned that you can become an easy target for anything that you've done or not done. And it was a quite an experience in and of itself. So, but very stressful, as you can imagine.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. So given that, the information, especially from the BACB too, I recommend that it move forward to the board for approval.
Excellent. We will move to applicant number 10, which is Maggie Toombs. Dr. Rates, you're the lead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declarations, finds it to be both administratively and substantively complete. I will just make a note that the individual is also in good standing with a license, as a licensed behavior analyst in the state of Alabama. And with that, I would recommend that we move it forward to the board.
Thank you. Okay, we will move on to application number 11, which is Cheyenne Carlson. Dr. Stenhoff, you're the lead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's see. So in my review of the file, including the applicant's education, supervised experience, examination, performance, and declaration, well, I'm going to back up there. I did, in reviewing the file, I did note there was no evidence of licensure for Victoria Frescura and Monica Reveille. Ms. Carlson did provide an email explaining the absence of the documentation from her application. However, it was noted in there from Ms. Carlson that I believe Ms. Reveille has left the industry in regard to being a behavior analyst. But we don't have any information related to the Texas licensure at the time from both Ms. Frescura and Reveille, and whether they were licensed behavior analysts and were they eligible to supervise. One of the issues pointed out again by Ms. Carlson is that both are no longer licensed in the state. And I also went to look for the Texas licensure from both, and I wasn't able to obtain either one of them. So I don't know, and this is I'm seeking advice here. Do we need to have the two of them submit an email indicating as such, or do we accept as is and move forward? I'm not clear on that one. So maybe Ms. Galvin or Ms. Pakenham.
Yes, Madam Chair, Dr. Stenhoff. Slightly speculative on my part, but the way, if our system did not capture or reflect, with the license verification on our website, if it didn't encompass the past, which is what we care about in this instance, then any person could come to this board and make a public records request. And so we would, provide whatever records that we had to reflect, okay, this person was licensed in, you know, 2015 or whatever on the state in 2015. So my hunch is that the applicant can go to the Texas board and explain that while, you know, there is information about these individuals on their directory, it does not encompass all of the licensure history. So make that public records request. And so the way I see this working is issue a fare, you know, be clear about, you know, what needs to be obtained. But, you know, for the applicant's benefit, I'm really trying to explain what this looks like. You know, Freedom of Information Act, sometimes it's called more on the federal level, or a public records request for the information.
Okay. So in that case, given the information we have or lack thereof, you know, I'm going to recommend that a fare be given to request that information from the applicant. All right. Thank you, Ms. Pacano, for the clarification.
I do see that the applicant is on the line. So just to reiterate, since we've had some questions today, a fare is a letter that you will receive from board staff that will detail what exactly the committee is requesting from you before we can move your application forward to the full board for potential approval. So any questions you have, we'll go through to board staff. All right. I believe that encompasses all of the applicants for licensure that came forth today. Ms. Malis, would you provide a review of the action requested by the committee for each of the applicants so we can make an appropriate motion? I can take a stab at it too. I'm not frozen, am I? Okay, great.
Madam Chair, are you able to hear me now?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you, because I was talking. So out of all of the applicants, they are moving forward, except for three applicants. The first one is Layla. We have to get information about how many hours she obtained before Mr. Young was licensed and how many hours after Mr. Young was licensed in Michigan, and also the amount of hours that she has obtained since June of 2024, and to clarify if she has her 1,500 hours. The second fare is for Raphael. There's two issues with his application. On the supervision verification, we need a name and a signature of the supervisor regarding Hillary. And there's also a typo dealing with the supervision training. The third fare is for Cheyenne, and that fare has to do with her requesting, doing a public records request from the state of Texas to get information about her two supervisors so that we can assure that they were licensed during the time of supervision.
Excellent. Is there a motion to move forward these applications as identified by Ms. Malis?
So moved.
Is there a second?
I will second.
Okay. The motion has been made by Dr. Stenhoff. It has been seconded by Dr. Byra. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. But it was seconded by Dr. Rates.
Dr. Rates.
Oh, I thought I saw your mouth move the whole thing. Okay, well, let's go back. The motion has been made by Dr. Stenhoff. It has been seconded by Dr. Rates. Is there any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion carries. Ms. Malis? Oh, I thought I saw Ms. Malis. Ms. Pekkanen. I'm just doing great with names. This is going really well.
We both had our hands up. I will defer to Ms. Malis if she needs to provide a code word. You're on mute. if you're attempting.
Well, I apologize. The next code word is books.
Books.
Ms. Packer.
Yes. So before we leave this agenda item, I think it's appropriate to raise this consideration with all credit to Dr. Stenhoff. He posed a question to me, which I in turn brought to Ms. Galvin relative to the committee considering shifting to a process just to shorten your meetings. You know, we've already implemented a change recently that I think, you know, I haven't heard any negative feedback to. But what this would consist of is, you know, yet another shift, essentially getting a little closer to a consent agenda approach, whereby, you know, if Dr. Stenhoff has four applications on the agenda, you know, he can indicate, you know, applications 2, 7, 9, and, you know, are substantively administrative and substantively complete and so forth. So I recommend they move forward, but then, you know, single out the one application in this instance where, you know, a more focused time is needed. So, you know, again, with a long agenda with, you know, 30 names, we could save, you know, quite a bit of time. And, you know, I didn't see a problem with it. And more importantly, Ms. Galvin didn't. So if it's the consensus of the committee to implement that, don't worry, I'll train Dr. Davey and we can start that next month.
Consensus offered.
Okay.
Perfect. Hey. Thank you, Dr. Stenhoff. That was a wonderful suggestion.
Welcome.
All right. So agenda item number 5A is taken care of. There is also agenda item number 5B and 5C, which pertain to behavior analyst applications for licensure via universal recognition and requesting approval for telehealth registration. There were no applicants under these pathways. So those agenda items are just, we're moving right along. We have already tackled agenda item number 6, so we will move into agenda item number 7, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action concerning unlicensed board-certified behavior analyst employed in Arizona schools. Ms. Pakkinen, could you provide a summary of this matter that's coming before the committee again?
Yes, Madam Chair. So earlier in 2024, the committee, I'm sure, remembers considering this matter and, you know, in the process sort of, you know, contemplating what implications there may be if there is, as we suspect could be the case, that there are BCBAs in Arizona who believe they qualify for the exemption for licensure in 32.2091.08A1. At least, you know, some questions, even though the statute language has been in place for, you know, over a decade, 15 years almost, there may be instances where a critical mass, whatever that may be, of individuals that may be interpreting that language differently than what the language actually states, which of course, you know, requires that the Arizona Department of Education perform a function that they don't perform and that don't have the statutory authority to perform. And so, you know, understanding again that this may have, you know, implications for a number of stakeholders, not only the BCBAs, who may be, you know, operating under an incorrect assumption, but certainly, you know, the individuals who, you know, benefit from the delivery of their services. The committee wanted to approach this issue and find a resolution to it, if you will, that was that minimized the adverse impact. And of course, you know, the board needed to be informed as well of this issue. So it's coming back to you having been considered by the board. What I heard from the board, Dr. Stenhoff, I think you were there and recall, and hopefully you see it the same way, is that the board, you know, appreciated knowing about this issue and felt quite comfortable, you know, with the CBA, with the committee, you know, continuing to consider it and coming forward, you know, with a recommendation when the committee is ready. So the board trusts the committee, in short. As part of the process too, there's a responsibility on my part, of course, to inform the governor's office that while we don't know the magnitude, the impact, the depth and breadth of this issue, it was important to, you know, make sure they were aware of this, at least bring it to their attention. And if there were any concerns or direction that the governor might want you know, to be followed with respect to this issue, then, you know, of course we would follow, you know, that directive. I did do that piece, and I have not heard any response or feedback. So in the absence of that, I think that it's time for the committee to, you know, reconsider where we are with this matter, and what, if any, recommendation you might forward to the board. As part of this exercise, you asked for some data from other jurisdictions relative to, you know, is this an exemption that exists in those states? If so, what does it look like? How does it compare to Arizona? And I did none of that research. I did nothing of it. It's all credit due to Dr. Davis Wilson, who happened to pull it all out of her back pocket, for which I was extremely grateful. So I presented that to you for your consideration. You know, earlier in the meeting, we talked about, you know, it is daunting and uncertain to seek a statutory change. And so that is certainly not a solution that we could even pursue, you know, in the short term. We really need to be thoughtful about if and when, you know, we would come to the legislature with a request for this language to be retooled, whatever that looks like. I don't even think that conversation has happened yet, you know, in terms of what you think this exemption even needs to represent or consist of, right? And ultimately, you know, that's that recommendation would be, need to be approved by the board to move forward with you know, any proposed language changes. All that being said, you know, this isn't exclusively the board's responsibility to seek a statutory change. You know, any constituent in Arizona could ask any legislator to sponsor a bill to modify this language, and that could come from AZABA. It could come from an individual who, you know, really wants to see this language represent something different. The Department of Education, you know, may decide that this is something that they feel strongly about addressing. So just because the statute language is here in this form here now and today, it may not always be. But for now, what, if anything, do we do about it in terms of awareness, in terms of accommodating, you know, anyone who, again, may have, you know, with no malice, misconstrued this language. And so it's coming back to you for more discussion and possible formulation of a plan or a recommendation to take to the board.
Thank you for the summary, Ms. Pagman. Dr. Stenhoff.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think as far as public service to an extent is we're kind of in a difficult position because we have, especially now we're starting in the school year. In fact, several districts are in operation right now. And to put possibly put maybe students in a position where they're no longer receiving behavior analytic services by board certified behavior analysts to say that, well, you can no longer practice until such time that you're licensed. I'm not sure that that is a ideal situation for the student body of the state of Arizona. But also on the other side of it is I think we need to offer a deadline, you know, maybe allow, and I don't know the legality of this, but allow practice to occur or continue until whatever a reasonable deadline would be for application or even licensure. And maybe application might be the better way to look at it because the administrative, possible administrative workload that would increase because of that. So I think that's, we need to kind of consider that. And because of the safety, I want to say it that way, part of our duty is for the safety of the state of Arizona, but pulling off and saying you can no longer practice is not also providing safety to the student body of the state of Arizona. So those are my concerns when we initially look at it.
I agree with you, Dr. Stenholm. I think that, you know, it is definitely going to have an impact on board staff whenever we look at the fact that we just mentioned in this meeting earlier today, there's 160 applications in backlog right now. And this is not any of the new applications that are going to come forth as a result of new BCBAs being here. And then we add on top of that additional applications that will be coming forth from those behavior analysts who are practicing in schools without a license. I think that it would be problematic, at the least, to say until you're licensed, you can't practice, because we don't know how long that might be, even if they got in their application. So perhaps we could have, and like you said, legality-wise, that's Ms. Galvin's forte, not mine. But perhaps it could say your application must be submitted by this date, because once your application is submitted, the board does have jurisdiction over your practice to a certain extent. So I would be in favor of moving in a direction like that. Ms. Pakkinen?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember there was some discussion around a component of this issue, I'll say, which, and I don't know if a consensus was reached. I mean, it introduces some new complexity, but also potentially, you know, maybe a partial solution, if you will, that I'm hearing you say, you know, bring these BCBAs into, you know, into the regulated world of licensure, and you know, provide a reasonable time and, of course, you know, the support that we can provide and so forth. But the discussion that you had was related to if any of these individuals are certified in some other capacity, a closely related capacity by the Department of Education, perhaps, possibly, that means that they meet the spirit of the exemption. I think that's how I remember it, but I'm going to stop there because that's your conversation.
Dr. Stenholm?
Yeah. Thank you for the reminder, Ms. Pakkinen. Yeah, there are going to be professionals within the district that it would be under their job requirements to do those things that are similar to what BCBAs are required to do. Just a couple off the top of my head would be a special education teacher, possibly an SLP, a school psych would fall under that capacity as well. So I think within those bounds, those individuals might be, as you were saying, within the spirit of what is required, and would, if they're acting with that hat on, so to speak, while still being BCBAs, you could contend that there is that overlap. It's, you know, there's that Venn aspect of it that they would meet and not necessarily need that licensure because of their job duties under the other hat or other, being hired for the capacity of those areas that are listed or that I described too. So.
So if the committee is moving toward making a recommendation to the board about a communication, and we would solicit the BACB's assistance, of course, or maybe the Department of Education's assistance, of course, to, you know, craft a communication, the board meets next week. I don't see this practically coming to the board next week. I think there's work to be done, and I'd rather bring to the board, you know, a fully fleshed out, you know, thoughtful proposal, and have had, you know, some opportunity to re-engage with the Department of Education, affirm with the BACB that they can support, they would agree to support us, you know, from a communications perspective, because of course, you know, we only have the contact information for licensed behavior analysts. We don't have the ability to reach out to people who are not licensed, but in Arizona. So I think what we need to do is just thoughtfully pull together a plan. And I would like to work with someone from this committee, you know, to help pull together the elements of that plan and potentially have it to the board in September.
Madam Chair, if I may.
She looked pensive, but I think she was frozen.
Yeah. Ms. Pack and I'd be happy to help out with some of that documentation if you'd like.
You were my choice, so thank you.
Yeah.
This, of course, makes you responsible for the agenda item in September with the board.
And Madam Chair is back, and Ms. Pack and I, thank you for placing that responsibility on me.
So while I was just taking another break, apparently I'm just hopping off all the time, just taking my own little breaks. I'm presuming agenda item number 9 or number 8 has been wrapped up and we're ready to move to another agenda item.
Yes, Madam Chair, just for the benefit of making sure that understand, I think the consensus the committee arrived at is that Dr. Stenhoff and I will work on a plan to bring a proposal to bring to the board. And then there would need to be, you know, some effort on my part to engage with the stakeholders that I think are pretty obvious, the Department of Education. Confer with the BACB, they can help us with communications. What the board may very well do is review the proposal, but, you know, give more direction into what they want this to look like. Maybe they want more broad stakeholder input. You know, maybe there's something else that needs to be part of the plan, but let's give them something. Let's give them some material and some ideas to work with, some content to work with, and then we'll see where that goes. September 6th, I think, is the target date for that board meeting.
Okay.
And just to chime in, I imagine this has already been considered, but it would seem that it would be beneficial to bring AZABA into this when we are ready to make that communication as well as just another avenue for dissemination.
And I believe there is a SIG through AZABA. That's ABA in schools. Like that
that's
might
a great idea.
A particular pocket of parties who would be interested in knowing that information.
Yes.
Let's move on then to agenda item number 9, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding recent updates from the Behavior Analyst Certification Board. Ms. Pakkinen, the floor is yours again.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another month with no updates. I think that I still see some value in keeping this matter on the agenda because we never know, you know, when we're going to receive, you know, regulatory focused, you know, information coming from the BACB. I think they're probably sort of, you know, pivoting a bit, you know, with the retirement of Misty Bloom. And, but I don't think that that means that, you know, we'll no longer receive any updates or any information. I think that will resume at some point. The listserv is still active in the sense it's still available. I'm not seeing, you know, really a whole lot of, activity on it, but you know that could be due to a number of reasons. So, with that, nothing to report. But we'll just, if you agree, we'll just keep it on the agenda, and you know, and maintain our awareness and our engagement with the organization.
I think that sounds wonderful. I think that it is good to have a priority of our certification board staying on the agenda.
Very good.
We will move to agenda item number 10, which is discussion, consideration, and possible action regarding an invitation to participate as an exhibitor at the Division of Developmental Disabilities hosted Bridging the Gap for Individuals with Developmental Disabilities and Behavioral Health Needs Conference on September 7th of 2024. Ms. Pakkinen.
Yes, Madam Chair. So we received this invitation, which I think is described quite well in your materials. You know, I'm coming from a place of ignorance. I don't know if this is sort of a, you know, what one-time event or if it's something that is, you know, routinely held or, you know, what the case may be.
It's
but
it, brand
you
know, new. This oh, is wow. the inaugural conference, and maybe it will be reoccurring. But as far as I know, this is a debut.
Fantastic. But in a typical, typically I would see this as something that, you know, I would offer to staff, or I would agree to staff to represent the committee and the board. Unfortunately, I will be out of the state. Ms. Michelson will be out of town. And so it just happens to fall Saturday, September 7th on, you know, a non-ideal date for our purposes anyway. It is the day after a board meeting. And we haven't, while we weren't asked directly by this group, you know, staffing a booth for the other attendees, you know, the 2 days prior is also not practical. The day before and the day of a board meeting, staff just can't get away to do that. So I'm bringing this to the committee to ascertain whether or not there's availability among the four of you, and, you know, Dr. Davey can't elude me for very long, but, you know, could we cobble together enough representation to staff the booth, or is this just going to have to be an opportunity that we, you know, have to regretfully decline because we just don't have the capacity to do this? So that is the proposal.
I will not be available to cobble. I will already be at another booth.
I would be happy to participate. I don't know that I can do the entire day, but I can certainly do a good chunk of it if there's someone else that can support it with me.
I could probably like swing by, but it shouldn't be relied upon. But I'll be there.
Madam Chair, Ms. Packard, I'm going to have to look at my calendar a little more closely. I do have some things going on, but I might be able to move them around too. So,
and I think in the case of Dr. Byra, one of the considerations that, you know, needs to be made is that, you know, she's a considerable distance from Phoenix. And so that's, you know, kind of a challenging kind of, you know, request to make. Dr. Byra, you would be, of course, eligible for the incredibly generous mileage reimbursement and, you know, possibly the meal. I think the meal reimbursement, which may buy you a sandwich, but not a cookie. So, you know, for what that is worth, but, you know, also from just a time and practicality perspective, you know, that's something that you need to think of. And, you know, my first question when this came to me was, what's the cost? We haven't budgeted for anything like this. You know, so travel reimbursement would, you know, not be a huge dent in our budget, but it's not budgeted for. So I just, you know, raise that information just for consideration purposes.
I wouldn't be concerned about the mileage. It's just really like a 5-hour return, you know, trip in the car to potentially cover part of a day. I'm also pretty confident my husband's also traveling for work at that time. And so in addition to the time away from home, I'd have to secure childcare for, I don't know, 5 a.m. until whenever I get back. So I'm sorry, I'm going to have to pass. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, understood. Well, what I'm hearing is that go ahead, Dr. Reitz.
I was just going to say, if others can't, I can make arrangements to be there the whole time. So if we want to commit to that, I'm happy to do that. But if there, you know, Dr. Stenhoff or Dr. Davey finds the opportunity, that would be great. But otherwise, I'm happy to do it.
So why don't I do this? I will communicate with the three of you and see if we can't sort of, you know, arrive at some sort of a, you know, a shift arrangement. And then I'll also confirm with the event sponsor if, you know, even a portion of the day for coverage is acceptable. So look for my email next week. This is, of course, predicated too on, I know that we've missed the deadline, and I did explain, you know, that we wouldn't be able to submit an interest form or an application ahead of the deadline. I was very clear about when, you know, this would be, you know, when I could have clarity, which is today, next week. At any rate, if there's still space, then terrific. If we're told that, you know, the space has all been obligated, and, you know, hopefully we can secure an invitation next year. So thank you.
All right. Agenda item number 11 is new agenda items for future meetings. Do any committee members have items that they would like to propose for future meetings? Okay. Agenda item number 12, adjournment. Is there a motion at 12:05?
So moved.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay, the motion has been made by Dr. Stenhoff to adjourn this meeting. It has been seconded by Dr. Reitz. minutes. Is there any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion carries. Everyone have a fabulous weekend.